Do you like the Star Wars? Well, we do too here at the Rancor Pit. I'm Cole Jedi Cole Houston coming to you as always from deep within Jabba's Palace. And joining me, another of the denizens. You know, we got the place for a song when tragically Jabba's sail barge inexplicably exploded. You know, you take them out on the dune sea, couple of trips, and one day they just explode.
That's right. And I'm Eddie Medina coming to you, refugee from the planet of Endor, and hiding out also in Jabba's dungeon.
We've had more fun, though, I'll tell you right now, with that power droid on the that rack.
That could be it taken just, the wrong way, but okay.
Yeah, it just squeals and I better just stop right there. Don't watch Return of the Jedi, you perverts.
Yeah, that reminds me of a meme, and this is totally off subject, but that's what we do around here. Someone posted a thing of different robots throughout the entertainment ages, beginning with Metropolis up to, like, RoboCop, and oddly enough, one of the robots on this thing was the little girl from Small Wonder.
I saw that. I'm not sure, and I couldn't tell for certain, but I did notice someone put Small Wonder. Really?
That was me. that was me.
Wow,
and then
I just kind of gave it a cursory once over. I didn't realize that was you.
Yeah, and so it was posted by our mutual friend Jason McLean, and he tried to get smart about it, as he often does, and says, you know, don't knock Small Wonder, or Vicky, I guess the character's name is. He said, don't knock Vicky, you know, she can kick Data's butt. And I said,
Is it Vicky, like, normally spelled, or was it, like, something like Vic-E?
Oh, no, he's
spelled like,
normally.
Oh, and, yeah, Vicky.
And honestly, I'm proud to say I don't know enough to know that much about the name spelling, so I'm proud of that fact.
But that's good.
I did mention to him, I said, well, you do realize that she did grow up to become a Japanese pleasure robot. So that kind of ties into your little dirty joke of the dungeon droid.
And
here
so we go full circle.
Yes.
You know, these just get dirtier all the time if you saw the last Rancor Pit Live.
Well, it is Tatooine. Things get dusty and dirty pretty quickly around
That's
here.
Right, because, and sand gets into everything.
That was a little bit William Shatner-esque.
Yeah, it was. It was sort of like Jake Lloyd and William Shatner. If Jake Lloyd was William Shatner's son.
Oh, I could see that, actually.
Yeah, sad but true.
Well, let's clean things up a bit and get into the topic for tonight.
By now, if you've read the title of this week's episode, you're probably wondering, why are we, you know, do we even really have a topic, or is this Rancor Pit Live all over again? And the reality is, yes, as you know, we took a week off last week. We disappeared. Part of it was closing the deal on Jabba's Palace. Part of it was Father's Day. Part of it was just exhaustion. Normally, we would be doing the Rancor Pit Live. Deep Ellum Studios are closed today. We are opting to go ahead and just sort of mix up our schedule a little bit. We'll probably have another chance to reset and get back on the old original schedule, which ironically, the live schedule and the not live schedule used to correspond brilliantly with our convention appearances.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that this switch may throw that a bit, so we'll have to have another reset somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
But we are here to talk about, in honor of the Father's Day show we didn't do, we talked about on the live show how we really weren't ever going to get around to, there weren't a lot of good father figures in Star Wars. And in retrospect, we realized there really was one good father figure out of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was Ponda Baba, who had seven children.
Walrus Man for the
Walrus Man for the old schoolers out there.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, George Lucas, effectively the father of Star Wars.
Yeah.
We definitely need to give some coverage, because without George Lucas, there would be no Star Wars. Without Star Wars, there would have been no event at Redbird Mall for Eddie and I not to meet each other at.
Yeah, to meet each other, not meet each other. Yeah. And I've been wanting to do a Lucas episode for a while, and what better time to do it because he is the father of Star Wars.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people, the name George Lucas, if it were to pop up back in the 70s, 80s, even the early 90s, you know, it was met with a lot of praise and admiration from fans, but unfortunately, a lot of times when George Lucas's name gets brought up now, you hear a lot of snide remarks, a lot of, you know, just negative things attached to it. And we kind of want to bring back a little bit of Lucas love to the Star Wars universe with this episode.
Absolutely. Much in the way that Eddie and Colleen on one of the recent live shows brought some love to episode one. we do want to kind of give some love back, because Eddie and I both grew up where, you know, Star Wars for us, like so many people, had this just amazingly profound impact.
Exactly.
An unexpected impact. And, you know, I was very fortunate from the outset that, you know, my mom recognized what this was going to be. She knew this was a phenomenon from the outset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that notwithstanding, I was already just completely captivated.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked at length on this show, and I know I've talked about it on many other shows, about everything that went right to make that phenomenon happen.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it really makes Lucas a very interesting character and a bit of a tough nut to crack if you do go and look at the progress of what it took to get Star Wars made. Mm-hmm. And the starting point and how many just happy accidents
mm-hmm.
ultimately made what could have just been another hackneyed, you know, Samuel Z. Arkoff. Giant Gila monsters with sail fins glued to their back.
Yeah.
Type of production. And
It very much could have gone in that direction. And that's the thing, and that's where the internet can be good and bad. You had a lot of where the internet was starting to flourish, and a lot of these news groups and chat rooms started to pop up, especially in the news groups back in the day. You started hearing about these other young filmmakers, and people would make a big deal of, like, say, someone like Robert Rodriguez, where when he made El Mariachi, and he did it on
$6 and change, I believe.
Exactly. And that led to him making a name for himself and doing Desperado and then going on to bigger movies. And the internet kind of helped immediately throw all this attention right away into Robert Rodriguez and what he had to go through and what he did to pull off his dreams. And Lucas went through something very similar, but he didn't have the benefit of having the internet to tell his story at the time. We had to get a story later on through books, you know,
had to go to an analog source and read real books. And
Yeah. But even those books didn't come out until much later. They
absolutely.
Were retrospective in themselves.
I think that, you know, once the phenomenon hit, then people want to know, well, who is this George Lucas guy? And that's rather, you know, the kind of question we're going to be asking now is, you know, who is this George Lucas guy?
Mm-hmm. And granted, again, people like to be negative, but what a lot of people don't understand is no one is going to always bat 1,000, no matter what field they're in. And, you know, you could take your favorite athlete, and they will more often than not strike out at the plate than hit a home run or even, you know.
Yeah, look what happened to Mighty Casey, and then he killed himself afterward.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Yeah, he was so distraught that he'd pretty much ruined Mudville for all time.
That's right. Or Ponda Baba. A lot of people don't realize that he was on a
He was a heavy hitter.
He had a good career until you lost an arm, actually.
Yeah, he was very big in collegiate. He was a collegiate athlete, well on his way to being drafted. he was riding that fence that so many young creatures do, where, you know, do I go ahead and graduate or do I go ahead and go for the Bucks?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize he was a free agent for a while for the Kashyyyk Wookiees. You know,
really? I didn't know that.
That's right. That's yeah.
Oh, so he was armless Fonda.
the
one-handed hitter. Yeah.
The one-armed wonder.
One-armed wonder, the one-handed hitter.
He didn't do too well in his interviews on the Galactic Sports Network. You know, a lot of people couldn't understand his grunts and but, you know, he still made a name for himself.
They really needed to pony it up for recall droid.
But since we're back off topic again.
Yeah.
People, and no one's going to have a perfect career, but I think if you really look at George Lucas's career, he did so much more right than he did
Absolutely. And to go from, you know, an inexplicable student film to an inexplicable Hollywood remake of that inexplicable student film.
Well, you know what? Even before THX, his first student film was only a minute long. I discovered this a few years back.
Oh, wow.
And this is the thing about George Lucas, that people just assume that his dream was to get American Graffiti or Star Wars on the big screen, and it really wasn't. George Lucas ended up at USC because he had aspirations to become a photographer, not a filmmaker. And he only ended up at USC taking film and the film classes because he thought that was the closest he could take to get to doing photography courses. And it was during these USC film courses that he started to develop his love and passion for filmmaking. And his first student film, like I said, was a minute long, and it wasn't even so much moving images. It was a series of still shots that he took. And it and I'm not completely familiar with what the story was, because, again, it's been a few years since I found this out, but it was something like, it told the story in still images of a person trying to escape Nazi-occupied Germany, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And trying to make his way to
that's pretty deep, you know.
And I would hope it's
You know, when you hear student film in 1 minute, you think it's just like one of those really assy people who decide, you know, I'm going to make a 1 minute film. There were no, you know, you didn't have any criteria there on length.
And nowadays, if you hear that, it's usually a film comprised of images of like an eyeball and then a toilet seat and a flower, you know, and it makes no sense. But I'd be curious to know if this.
I was waiting for you to go on to the next one because it was making perfect sense to me up to that point.
Up to that point,
just tapered off. I was really into this film.
That's why I'm not a filmmaker. Yeah. And I would hope that this film is somewhere on YouTube that you can view it, because I'd be curious to see what it is. But
yeah,
that actually garnered him the attention to go on and make THX.
Well, I also want to point out, as someone who has made student films as a student filmmaker. A 1 minute student film is very cost effective because, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, it was expensive as all hell to make a student film.
It definitely was. Yeah, it was.
And then you had to, you know, either wait a week to get your film back or, you know, if you pay a lot at the local processing lab.
And you know what? Maybe that's why he did his first film as just still images. Maybe it was a lot quicker and cheaper for him to do it that way. And
you know, it's simultaneously artsy fartsy.
Yeah, exactly, and it ended up working in his favor because it got the attention for kind of standing out from the other student films. Could be for that very reason.
And then, you know, to go from that to another film about literally breaking free of a totalitarian society with THX-1138, which, you know, who can really say what was going on there? Still, you know, I've seen some footage from the student version.
Yeah.
And it's remarkably high production values.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that really set Lucas apart in the early days is, you know, he could take, you know, it would be like, you know, here's $5, see what you can do with it. And he was one of those creators who could take that $5 and make magic. And I think that, you know, not to to push too far forward to the point where people started complaining about him, but I think in a lot of ways that limitation drives certain creators far better than having a blank check.
Yeah. And he took that mentality of getting the most for his dollar when he did Star Wars or any of his movies, even before then, American Graffiti. He got the most for each dollar that he made. I can't remember how much they made Star Wars on, but it was for really for what they did was really an amazing feat in itself. And of course their budget doubled when they did Empire, but if you go back and I really wish I had the figure in front of me of how much it cost, but it's nothing compared to
it was actually considered a fairly low budget film in its day. In fact, if you really want to just immerse yourself wholeheartedly in the process, and I've recommended this before and can't recommend it enough. In fact, probably I'll probably bring all three in on the next Rancor Pit Live the next time we do the Jedi Temple Library. J.W. Rensler's comprehensive The Making of Star Wars the definitive story behind the original film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is a massive tome that, if you can get it, it's the only one of the three, I believe, that has ever been published in paperback, which is highly annoying because the hardcovers of Making of Empire and Making of Jedi weigh about 40 pounds. so not good reading material when you're sitting up in bed trying to hold this colossus up.
But it's a good workout tool if you don't have your barbells close by.
You can kind of exercise body and brain simultaneously.
That's right. That's
right. You know, it's a huge book. It's chock full of archival imagery and things like receipts and call lists and all kinds of things from the archives that you would never see.
Oh, wow.
You know, cocktail napkins were... Somebody writes, oh, Jabba, that's a good name. that sort of thing.
So it's really in-depth.
Yes, it is very in-depth. And the best part about it is it takes you on a chronological journey from, you know, the success of American Graffiti and the ability to kind of do what you want to a sincere and original desire to make a Buck Rogers movie. No, was it Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon? I can't remember which now.
I think it was more Flash Gordon.
Yeah, it was Flash Gordon. That was the one. They actually wanted to make a real Flash Gordon movie, you know, for the modern audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rights were immovable. Mm-hmm. They just were inaccessible.
Yeah.
So literally, Star Wars, you know, this amazing phenomenon of original characters and original stories and so many things about it that are so amazingly, brilliantly original and new was born out of desperation and frustration for not being allowed to adapt something that already existed.
And inevitably turned it into something bigger and, in my opinion, better.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And there are so many little subtleties because in the early drafts, one of the neat things is this book takes you through the early drafts. It tells you the story that was going to be the film.
Yeah.
And that's why Dark Horse was able to publish The Star Wars based on those original scripts. And it's just this disjointed bunch of flying all over the galaxy and doing stuff and you know, half the time you're like, why? And, you know, it's got more characters than the Bible, and it just goes on and on. And you realize, you see a really good glimpse of the process that the best Hollywood films go through. And that's, you know, taking it to family and friends and them saying, yeah, about this. And better ideas coming. It's like, well, why don't, instead of doing this, you know, it's almost the process is almost brilliantly lampooned, possibly by accident, by the movie George Lucas in Love, where he's trying to decide what kind of space wheat or space corn or space oats his farmer is farming.
and that's that could be said of anything in its early stages, whether it's the first, you know, version of Batman being a blonde guy with red tights and a domino mask, or even Raiders of the Lost Ark. There was a lot of tweaks that were made, a lot of changes that were made before it became Raiders of the Lost Ark that we know.
Oh, yeah, there's a great Jim Steranko production illustration.
Yeah.
And Indy's got a big cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah, yeah. And Tote originally was a cyborg, which is interesting.
Oh, that's right.
But even anything else, like even with Die Hard, Die Hard isn't the Die Hard that it was in the original novel. I think it's called 48, 49 minutes or something like that. It's something very different if you were to ever read the book than what ended up as Die Hard on the screen. I mean, the novel is definitely not bad, but they took that and they tweaked it to make it something a little bit more adventurous and exciting for the big screen. And that can be said for anything, you know, Star Wars
absolutely
included.
But especially in this case where it wasn't adapting something that pre-existed, and it started out so vastly different from where it wound up.
Mm-hmm.
And then how often the whole production was just on the edge of never happening.
Oh, yeah.
And you read this and you wonder, you really... I gained a tremendous admiration for George Lucas as a creator, as a filmmaker, as a person, because there were so many points. It's this comedy of errors wrapped in this giant mass of shortcomings and tragedies. And, you know, ILM was just basically a circus.
Oh, yeah, with a bunch of hippies.
Until somebody came in and tightened the reins and said, you know, fun time is over.
Yeah, there was that one.
Foreman showed up and told him what for. And
yeah, there's that one story of the ILM employees. Of course, Lucas is over in England filming, and they're back in the States, and there's one point where they have a makeshift water slide, and they're all, you know, goofing off and probably high as kites at this point. And the Fox executives drive up, and they see all these hippies just having a blast outside of the studios when they should be inside working. And I can only imagine the phone call that George Lucas got for that day.
And one of the other things that really amazed me, and you don't think about these things,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the production was very much handled in England.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you know that locations, one of the principal locations was in Tunisia.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the studio. They're loading up all the cameras and equipment, and scaffolding and thing, costumes, props, etc.,
mm-hmm.
to drive to Tunisia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought, well, that's weird. But you don't think about the fact that they literally, all the stuff came from England.
Yeah.
They ferried it across the channel, then literally drove on the roads from France to Africa.
Yeah.
They didn't fly that crap in here. They drove it.
Yeah.
Across multiple countries. And, you know, when you're in the States, you don't think about the fact that so much of Europe is like the United States, except that all the states are sovereign countries
mm-hmm.
of about the same size as many of our states.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you don't think about these weird little things like, you know, you could drive through like 10 or 12 countries to get where you're going. But, you know, that they could do all of this on a shoestring. And when you went to see it, like in my case in 77, you'd never have known this. It didn't look like a low-budget picture. It didn't feel like a low-budget picture.
That's right.
And there were so many nuances. And you know, a lot of that is very Lucas,
mm-hmm.
but at once a lot of it is a lot of other people,
mm-hmm.
and but the underlying vision was there, and you had a director who took charge, but also knew when to let his actors do their thing. He also knew when to let other people, at least at that stage in his career, you know, let other people advise him, and he took to heart a lot of the things. And he also, to a large degree, was listening to the fans after Star Wars had come out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he had to find creative ways to stay within budget, so it forced him to be a little bit more creative, whereas with the prequels, the sky was the limit. And there was, you know, budget could allow for a lot more, but with Star Wars, a lot of the excitement and wonder that we got from the final product was born out of the fact that he had to find creative ways to tell his story.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that concerns me going into the Disney stuff, because talk about your blank checks.
Uh-huh. Well, thank goodness, though, with the new ones, J.J. Abrams has already said that he's trying to keep it as old school as possible, where he's doing practical effects and he's filming on film as opposed to digital. But, if we could just take a quick step back before we get too far into the production of things, back to the era from his USC days to his American Zoetrope days with Francis Ford Coppola, a lot of people may not know the story of what got Lucas focused on becoming a serious film student. Back in June of 62, you know, we already know that George Lucas was very fond of of fast cars and hot rods and such as can be seen in, you know, American Graffiti. He was driving his Fiat around the curvy back roads of I guess, is it Northern California where he was from?
I believe so, yes.
And so June of 62, he's driving home. And he hits the turn to drive into, I guess, the driveway of his family's house. He hits the gravel road, flips his Fiat, gets tossed from it, knocked unconscious, and the car gets wrapped around a tree.
Oh, yeah.
So,
he had a bad accident from which the concept of the force had actually come to him during
And so the paramedics show up, and he's literally near death. He's unconscious, and they take him to the hospital, and he spends the next 4 months recovering. And it's during this time that he starts to realize, you know what, instead of wasting my years just kind of haphazardly going from one thing to another, why don't I get a little bit more focused on what I want to do? And it was from those 4 months of meditating and rediscovering himself that he decided to get serious and get enrolled in USC. And from there, he went on to do work alongside Francis Ford Coppola. And from there also, you know, we get THX-1138 and everything else. But I always thought it was interesting, and I think this is where I relate a lot to George Lucas, is in school, he was very much a D student, as, you know, it was very common with artistic-minded people. I was never a strong academic student, but my mind would never stop going when it came to, you know, creating these comic strips and comic book characters while I was in school. And apparently
Absolutely.
Lucas was the same way. And Cole, I don't know your academic background, but I would imagine.
Oddly enough, much to my surprise, I sort of inadvertently got serious about my education at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Without realizing I had. part of it, I think, was being very fortunate. I will always credit the fact that in, you know, the little town where we were by high school, some teachers there had the good sense to recognize in me what I didn't recognize in myself. And I distinctly remember going to register for my junior year and being informed I was in advanced English.
Yeah.
At which point I informed them there must be some kind of mistake because I really didn't pay enough attention to my own aptitudes, but someone mm-hmm. else did.
Mm-hmm.
And that forced kind of an awakening there. Academically, like, math was never my strong suit.
Oh, me either.
But I was English, I had a much better command of the language and the written communication and such than I ever realized until somebody started challenging that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where I was awakening, as going from just being a very highly creative, constantly thinking individual to being a writer. So I know what you mean. I mean, much to my surprise, I graduated 10th in my class. It was not a huge class, mind you. Less than 100 people.
That's actually very coincidental. I believe I graduated 10th in my class, too, but being a small private school, there was only 20 of us, so it's not hard to do.
Right. There were 83 of us graduating. So.
I think Colleen was probably like 3 or 4 in the class, so that shows, you know,
But I see what you mean, that, you know, very often the creative mind has no room for a lot of other things, and you can certainly see the process being borne out on the screen when you realize what all was brought to bear.
Yeah, and Lucas, again, being not so much an academically strong student, he took all his focus and put it into being, you know, artistic, and he even admits himself that his and back in the day, I'm not sure about now, but back in the day, he would say that his weaknesses was in writing and characterization. He said his strength was always in editing a film. And I think that's why he always pushed himself a little bit harder in the writing department. And he got a lot of encouragement back in the day from Francis Ford Coppola, to, you know, he would tell Lucas, okay, you believe that writing is your weakness. Well, then take that weakness and put all your focus on it and, you know, become better and push yourself harder and discover new ways of telling a story that somebody hasn't told the way that somebody hasn't told before. And so I think that was really good that he had that kind of direction. And I think and he took a lot of what Coppola said to heart, because a lot of people don't realize that back in the day, you would go to film school, and a lot of times you would graduate and end up either in a clerk position or Lucas said that the successful stories that came out of USC back in the day were the guys who came out of the school and ended up directing commercials or TV. It wasn't exactly a success story because it wasn't anything that anybody aspired to do, but Coppola was the first success story back in that era. He actually graduated school and went on to immediately do feature films. So he became almost like a legend in the campus. So for Lucas to find himself working next to him a few years later, I think that was really good, because the advice that he would give George Lucas, George really took that to heart and tried to work on his game a little bit better.
Well, as I say, you know, back then he had the good sense to turn to others. You know, he recognized he was not
the best
storyteller. He had amazing concepts and ideas and such.
Uh-huh.
But ultimately what had to happen was he had to bring in others to, you know, a lot of the dialogue comes from other writers. A lot of the little things. But, you know, overall, the big picture, to conceive of something like that in a period where absolutely all science fiction was based on Earth, especially cinematically or on television.
Yeah.
I can't go on enough about the fact that to this day, I'm thoroughly impressed that Earth has nothing to do, and it's not in the future. Those two concepts alone elevate Star Wars to the pinnacle.
Yeah.
Because that's just unheard of. And to establish that with the most tiny of exposition in itself is pure genius. And then, you know, you move into his early career, and he is able to tell a kind of semi-autobiographical story with American Graffiti.
Yeah.
And to tell a story, I think, that even in its day, really nobody thought would resonate.
you know,
this was the 70s, for God's sake, and who wants to know what kids were up to in the 50s?
That's a good point.
And, you know, it's odd that that mentality remains to this day. There was a big push, for example, when Watchmen was at Columbia, they wanted to bring the story into the modern day. They thought it was ridiculous. The 80s were too recent.
Oh, I didn't know they wanted to do that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, had Columbia gone forward, Watchmen would have taken place in the same year that it was released, or in the same period it was released. The concept to them of, you know, putting out a film in the 2000s that took place in the 80s was patently ridiculous. Who would want to see a period film of an era that wasn't a minimum of 60 years ago?
Yeah.
And the reality is that, you know, these things resonate because people have a greater connection. You know, I feel a stronger connection to the 80s than I do to Victorian England. You know, 80s America than I do Victorian England, because I am an American who grew up in the 80s.
Exactly.
So, you know, conceptually, I'm sure there was some resistance to doing a film about the 50s and the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that opened up a floodgate of suddenly the 50s were hip.
Yeah, yeah. And led way to happy days, inevitably. But, you know, that's interesting that you say, you bring up the fact that it was a period piece, I guess a period piece, because if you think about it, every single film that Lucas has done, whether it's Star Wars or whether it's Tucker or Red Tails, they don't take place in modern time. They always take place in a different time and in a different era. And
that's a good point.
He's never made a film where it takes place in the same.
Kind of resonates with the, you know, never aware of where he is, what he is doing.
And I think people,
and the what he's doing part comes into play much more down the
exactly.
line.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing, because although Lucas was basing it on, quote, Flash Gordon, he wasn't necessarily basing the story of Star Wars on science fiction. I think he was basing it more on, say, like Greek mythology or the Bible, and that's why you got a story where it takes place in the past as opposed to the future. And because he was a big, he studied a lot of the mythology of other cultures, and that's where he drew a lot of his inspiration for the storyline of Star Wars, not from science fiction so much. He told it in a science fiction
format,
yes, thank you. But it wasn't necessarily a science fiction story, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that, I think that's why it became a phenomenon, because it was immediately considered a modern mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And the also there was a the influence of Flash Gordon, I think, is strongest in the fact that you have all of these different worlds and all these different cultures and all these different creature types, and they're all valid,
mm-hmm.
as it were, within the context of the greater story. And I think what he does brilliantly in that regard is to capture that sense of wonder, mm-hmm. that growing up with Flash Gordon, there had to be, like, you know, all these different worlds and the, you know, simultaneously coexisting, and you know, there's just so much there,
yeah,
at your disposal as an audience, as a, you know, in that case, as a reader, or you know, it's just really, I think that's one of the things, is it has that sense of wonder that had to have been felt by people reading Flash Gordon and such back in, you know, when it was a serialized comic strip.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I guess we could touch a little bit now that we go from American Graffiti to Star Wars, and the thing is, American Graffiti was a big gamble. No one knew how it was going to play out, and it ended up being a big hit. And once the money started rolling in to Lucas's bank account from American Graffiti, he immediately funneled that into the production of Star Wars.
Well, what you had there was a wonderful kind of double blessing, is you know, the success brought two things. It brought in the money,
mm-hmm.
and it brought in the notoriety as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, here he was, a proven filmmaker, and what Lucas brings to the table next was not exactly what anyone expected.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, here is, for one thing, a movie with war in the title, and aren't we a little tired of that? And mm-hmm. And it's a space fantasy like that ever sells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, there are so many aspects of it that were so many strikes against.
Yeah, the studio didn't want the word war in it, because they said it's going to immediately turn off any of the tickets sales for female, for women. They said no female is going to want to go see a movie with the term war in it.
Yeah, and I think there was a lot of feeling about, you know, as a country, we're still smarting from wars in Asia.
Yeah.
And there were just so many reasons not to to go with this thing. And luckily, the just tenacity and shopping it around and just refusing to let the thing die,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
made all the difference in mm-hmm. bringing that movie to the screen. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure it led to countless people kicking themselves.
But that speaks to what the vision he had for what he wanted to tell. You know, he even though he was told otherwise, change the name, do this, that, and the other, he was smart enough to listen.
Lose the guy with the pointed ears.
Yeah.
No, so that's Star Trek.
That was another visionary. He stuck to what he believed he needed to do to tell his story. And it wasn't an easy story to get told, as we find out from the production, the history of the production of the first film. I mean, it was like he was up against so much stuff. They tried to start filming in Tunisia, and they get hit with a sandstorm. He wanted special effects to be done a certain way. They're funneling money into ILM to get these production shots done, only to find out months later he goes over to see the shots that they have for him, and there's nothing that he can use in Star Wars. So now he's stressing over the fact that he's wasted time and money on special effects that aren't up to par. And yeah. He had to check himself to the hospital, right? Because he started getting chest pains at one point after seeing
that
what ILM had turned
familiar.
Out. Yeah, after he went back to the States and seeing the special effects shots, he started to experience chest pains and was thinking he was having a heart attack. Went to the hospital. They said, "Well, no, it's stress related. You need to take a chill pill," basically. And so he was literally making himself sick over getting Star Wars, produced.
Yeah.
And, but again, this speaks to the man's character back in that era where he wasn't going to let that stop him. He wasn't going to let that slow him down. He had to get this done. I mean, he was, at this point, he had to get it done because he was hip deep in all this.
Yes, indeed.
But, and through all those obstacles, through all those things that could have completely derailed the film, it still got made. And not only did it still get made, but it came out and it became such a smash hit. So, man, what a sigh of relief that must have been for not just George Lucas, but for the studio, for it to have the reaction that it did once it actually came out.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And then to, to have made it through all of that and thankfully having Alan Ladd champion the film throughout Lucas must have made quite an impression on Alan Ladd Jr., to be sure. And then, to have the film come out and be, what's really amazing is back then, be patently unaware initially that it had become a phenomenon.
Yeah.
The thing finally got out. It's bound to be a huge sigh of relief. And then, it's back then, I've talked about it before on different shows, is back in the 70s, even a major motion picture, like now, Transformers comes out or Avengers or any number of like big pictures or even, not genre pictures, but any kind of movie that has some big stars in it, like, if George Clooney does a romantic comedy, there's probably no major metropolitan area in the U.S. where you would have a hard time finding it playing somewhere.
Yeah.
And back then, that was not the case.
No, it definitely
wasn't.
Stuff
would open here and there. I mean, Empire Strikes Back, when it came out, as big a thing as that was and as much anticipated as that was, it did not just show up at every theater. I was living in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and it was in one theater initially, opening weekend, and for quite a while after. It wasn't until Jedi in the early 80s that things started to shift a little bit. And,
yeah.
The studios were getting their stuff out to all the theaters more so. But at any rate, you have to understand this was a time when Star Wars opening week wasn't playing a hell of a lot of places. It probably wasn't playing the entire U.S. its opening week.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great story about how the success of Star Wars was discovered when, if I'm not mistaken, it was Lucas and others were dining across the street from, I believe, the Chinese theater, but certainly a theater in L.A.
Yeah.
And got curious about these long, round-the-block lines and realized that's the line for our movie.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
Because the dissemination of info was not instantaneous. You know, the box office receipts weren't tallied on, you know, Saturday at 7 and the weekend, you know, is declared a success or failure. So certainly, you know, as you go forward from late 70s into the early 80s when Empire Strikes Back is released.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you know, you don't have the internet. You don't have a lot of information flying around. Mm-hmm. And rumors are running rampant all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
This is a period where, you know, with the success of Star Wars Empire was a given.
Mm-hmm.
Even though sequels were uncommon. You know, nowadays mm-hmm. they're common as mud, but back then, you just, you know, you weren't guaranteed a sequel just because you had a great film.
Mm-hmm. And even then,
we're talking about the era when, you know, once in a blue moon, a movie would have a sequel because it just, I think, original material was sort of the order of the day still. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, culturally we thought of, why are we drawing back from the same well? You know, are we that?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Are we that lacking in new material?
And when you did have a sequel, a lot of times it wasn't a sure thing because oddly enough, if we want to go back to 1977 to talk about what came out about that same time, a few weeks after Star Wars came out, if I recall correctly, one of the sequels to The Exorcist came out. And there you go. You had a movie like The Exorcist that was a big success, but you had the sequel that was a complete flop.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a sure bet that just because a movie carried a name that you were familiar with, it was going to be a runaway hit. So he still had to step carefully into going into Empire. And I think that's where he started to realize he may need to hand over some of the aspects of filmmaking to other people. And probably the reason why he handed over the directing reins to Irving Kirshner was because he literally made himself physically sick doing A New Hope.
Absolutely.
And he had enough insight to the whole process and enough sense as a movie maker to go ahead and hand over the creative reins to other people for the sequel.
Not only that, but also to develop the story and very officially turn over the writing
mm-hmm.
to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
To, you know, very clearly say, you know, I'm going to lay the groundwork, but the specifics are definitely going to someone else, where it was less obvious with Star Wars how many authors had a hand in the finished product.
Mm-hmm.
Where with Empire, it was very much up front that, you know, I'm not writing this film.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I think that's why you see a little bit of a disconnect. It's rather subtle, but the characters are a little different. But arguably that works because they ought to be a little different after everything they've experienced together.
Yeah, that's correct.
And oftentimes when you change writers, you literally change characters to the point where, you know, so drastically where one writer is so enamored of their own work or just indifferent or does not want to have anything to do with or just is trying to distance themselves from a previous author's work, that some of the characterization that you know and love is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, that's an unfortunate byproduct of that. But, you know, you see that to a small degree. Like I said, it's very subtle, but but Lucas is still, you know, his presence is still there. He's very much guiding the stories. He's not just like turning everything over and, you know, just write whatever the hell you want. So
yeah.
It's still, you know, each subsequent film is still a very much a Star Wars film, the original trilogy.
Yeah, and the progression in the story felt natural. And like, say, for instance, Harrison Ford, he wanted Han Solo to grow as a character for Empire. He voiced his opinion that he felt maybe Han Solo was a little bit too, maybe two-dimensional and wanted a little bit more depth to the character. So I think that's why you saw a big leap in his character, his characterization from A New Hope to Empire. He became a little bit more deep. He became a little bit more lovable, and he was less of a scoundrel and more of a scoundrel with a heart, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so the progression in the characterization, you know, felt natural from New Hope to Empire to Jedi, especially in Luke's story. You know, he went from being a whiny moisture farmer to a pretty confident Jedi Knight in Return of the Jedi.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But Lucas, from Empire, you know, to Jedi, by releasing the reins a little bit, we get better product, we get a little bit better story. And I think he oftentimes gets pegged with the idea that he wants to have creative control over everything. And it's not so much that. Like with Empire and Jedi, he allowed the filmmakers to do their take on the story. And yeah, I think the only time he really got knee-deep into the production of Empire and Jedi was in the editing process. He would take what Kirshner and Richard Marquand, is it Marquand? How do you say it?
Marquand.
He took what they did, and he tweaked it with his edits. And I think that's as far as where he got, you know, into.
Yeah, as I say, I think early on he had the good sense to, I think he always had the good sense early on to let other people, you know, have a big part of, you know, play their role and let them do what needed to be done.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you know, his presence is very much felt, and that's what's important, because that gives a kind of a sense of cohesion to the thing. But, you know, it really comes down to realizing the strengths and weaknesses that he created this world, but he's not very good at necessarily fleshing it out at full.
Mm-hmm.
And when Lucas allowed others to take up the reins a little bit, take up the slack, or to, you know, have a degree of creative control that helped guide the story and guide the characters and guide the universe, you got a much better product. Where things fall apart is a combination of a tremendous gap. But, you know, we're talking about George Lucas, the creator, not necessarily just George Lucas as the creator of Star Wars. And during that gap, what is remarkable about Lucas is, for someone who, you know, fell into filmmaking, he brought so much to the art and to the science, rather, as mm-hmm. well as the art.
Mm-hmm.
Because where he fails, you know, the shortcomings as a director or as a filmmaker are vastly outshined, in my opinion, by the contributions that were made to filmmaking in general.
I'm glad you brought that up. Because one aspect that a lot of people just immediately overlook because we're used to it is, in that era of the 70s, a lot of the music in movies was more 70s, had that 70s flair. It was more disco-like. It was more like, you know, what you think of when you think of the 70s. But he brought back a more orchestraic form of music to movies with Star Wars. He took a big gamble in having John Williams do a full orchestra for the music of Star Wars, because at that time, with like Logan's Run and some of these other science fiction movies, it didn't have that orchestra to, you know, producing the music. You had more of a disco kind of feel to the music.
Absolutely. You brought in one of the things that's a real strength of Star Wars is the very much a student of film approach
mm-hmm.
to the production. Because what had happened overall in filmmaking is, you know, you lose a lot of the I don't know, some of the conventions of the classic filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
that Lucas, as an avid student of filmmaking, borrows from the best and gives you this, what would otherwise have been a ridiculous space opera,
mm-hmm.
in the vein of everything that tried to rip it off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, again, one of the real strengths there is that everybody who tried to rip it off missed the point.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that it was a space opera. It was a damn good movie that happened to be a space opera. They weren't trying to make a good movie. They were trying to make a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
Oftentimes in a hurry and on the cheap.
Oh, yeah.
To bank on what they could, you know, draw from the phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think it was during that process, the formation of ILM, and then a kind of concerted effort at what else can be improved from, you know, how do we take the sound from the pre-production into the actual theater, the movie experience. He's, I think, one of the first filmmakers to try to embrace every aspect of the film from pre-production straight through to the actual delivery.
The presentation of the
presentation.
Film.
Yes, and it's just kind of a stunning thing there.
Well, even on the presentation part of it, Lucas helped to change the way that the movie studios looked at when a movie was going to be released, because back in the day, summer was the slow point in movie releases. It was ideal to have a fall release because you can be fresh in the minds of to be an Oscar contender, because it was at the tail end of the year. A lot of the big releases from the studios were released in the spring, but he changed the way the movie industry looked at the whole spring summer market.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, almost overnight, summer became the ideal time you wanted to release your movie. And a lot of that is attributed to movies like Star Wars and Jaws, because they helped to establish the summer blockbuster.
Absolutely.
And along with the whole presentation of the final product to the audience, we're overlooking, and this could be an episode in itself, but just to quickly touch on it, Lucas also helped to establish movie marketing, you know, like the way you're marketing it, not just in advertisement, not just through trailers, not just through the fact that he thought to market Star Wars through the convention scene by having, of all people, Mark Hamill stand at a table to tell convention goers about this movie called Star Wars. And imagine back in the day walking up to a table, picking up a one sheet of Star Wars and having Mark Hamill tell you about the film, giving you a sales pitch about the film.
Yeah.
It wouldn't happen.
Hey,
nowadays.
I'm in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And back then,
you could
people
see
were like,
either
okay.
Exciting or sad. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and to see it now, it's exciting to think of that actually happened. But he also helped to establish the marketing of a movie on the licensing side of things. Star Wars was geniusly marketed, I mean, albeit late, with the action figures a year late, but Lucas embraced the whole thing with marketing it as a toy, so he, all of a sudden, you left the theater as a kid, and now you got to go to the store, buy the toys, and relive that adventure in your backyard by, you know, with these action figures and toys. That wasn't done before then. Well, it was to a point. I mean, you had, like, Planet of the Apes toys and a few other things, but he really embraced the concept of what can we do with licensing to expand this beyond the movie theater.
Absolutely.
And so in a lot of ways, he was very much a visionary with how a movie was made, how it was produced, how it was presented, and how it could endure beyond its run in the theater. And that's why we have Star Wars enduring all these years later, because he put these little things in motion back in 1975, 76, and 77 that we've adapted to, we've worked into movie making as a whole nowadays. You know, that's why you get
transferred. One of the things is that a lot of what Lucas brings to the table is, frankly, good things that that movie benefit from. You know, there have been films that have brought in new technologies and new techniques and things like that that are, frankly, a bit of a flash in the pan in that they work perfectly in the context of the film that they were developed for. But then people, you know, filmmakers embrace them for all the wrong reasons. And a lot of what Lucas brings to the table is worthwhile, universally adapted. The multiple still frame technique that was developed to capture the unique fight scenes in Matrix became ridiculously popular for filmmakers. And it's like, no, you don't get it. It wasn't a success because, you know, it looks, you know, it's a cool thing. It was excessive because it looks cool in that context. You take it out of that context, it becomes a ridiculous sideshow attraction.
Yeah, that's a good point, because when you had that same Matrix style of freeze frame and do the, you know, the whole 360 rotation, when that starts showing up in Charlie's Angels, that's where you realize
they're
missing the point of why the effect was created in the first place.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think, and to speak about George Lucas, the filmmaker, I think the another reason why Star Wars was such a good movie and not just a good science fiction movie was because his mind wasn't so focused on, okay, this is a space story. It's got to fall into the traditional aspects of what a science fiction movie is. A lot of people don't realize that Lucas's focus back in the 70s, he wanted to be the one to make Apocalypse Now. And, of course, he ended up not making it, but at the time he was really focused on getting his hands on Apocalypse Now and developing it. So I think when he didn't get a chance to make Apocalypse Now, he took all that focus and energy. He was probably already in his mind thinking, this is how I want to make this movie. This is how I want to pull it off. This is how I think it will tell a good story. I think he took all of that focus from Apocalypse Now, and once he funneled all that into Star Wars, I think that helped contribute to the fact that Star Wars is just flat out a good cinematic piece and not just a good science fiction movie.
And, you know, not ironically, I guess, but, you know, we set out with this to kind of talk about Lucas and not be the Lucas bashers and avoid the Lucas bashing. And there's so much good to be said before the dark times, as it were. Before things got to a questionable point, that it's almost advisable not to go delve too deeply into
the dark time.
Yeah, to get into the point where things got a little dicey, where we dared to be cute, where we begin to lose some of the original focus. And there already was so much there that to talk about that was good, and luckily we're pretty much getting up to that point, I believe, if not exceeding it.
Yeah. Well, and
we need to be considering wrapping this up a little bit.
Yeah. And obviously, you no one is going to be a perfect filmmaker. No one's going to be a perfect movie producer, and George Lucas is by far perfect in any of those. But he is visionary. But as a visionary, as with any creative mind, I think a creative mind works best when it has other creative minds telling them what does work and what doesn't work. And I think when you had people like Alan Ladd and people like Robert Watts around you telling you, that's good, but let's execute it this way, or that's good, but let's take it in this direction. I think where the prequel suffered the most is Lucas didn't necessarily so much change as a filmmaker, but he was surrounded by too many yes men during.
Absolutely. That has been the prevailing comment when talking to anybody about it.
Yeah. His ideas and concepts were still there. They were still good. They were still his vision. But if Rick McCallum, I think, was too much of a yes man. He was anything that Lucas wanted to do.
He said, no,
that's a great idea, boss.
There was no counterpoint to anything.
Exactly. And I think that's really where the prequel suffered. That's not to take away from Lucas as a creative mind, as a creative person, but
there were good things in the prequels.
Oh, lots of good things.
They got overshadowed by the fact that no one came in and said, you know, there are things here that don't need to be here. There are things that should be here that are not.
Uh-huh.
And there are things that don't make a damn bit of sense.
And I guarantee you things like that would have shown up in the original trilogy had he been surrounded by yes men back in the day.
That's so true. Well, or you would have wound up with that original script. And that would have been the end of it. You know,
It
would have been something you went and saw, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if it was nothing else on, Smoking Bandit wouldn't be out for another week.
But Lucas, by and large, he is a genius. And I will always be grateful for what he gave us in not just popular culture, but giving us like a modern mythology. And he continues to this day. He continues even now to do good things. I mean, he sold Lucasfilm to Disney, and we've mentioned before that he gave a huge chunk of that money funneling it into education.
Absolutely.
And he's always been big on education. Even back during that dry spell between Jedi and the prequels, when he was developing LucasArts and the whole video game division, it wasn't like LucasArts was just putting out your typical video games, just like mindless entertainment. He was very big on incorporating a lot of educational stuff in his video games. And I think that speaks volumes to his character of wanting to just not give kids mindless entertainment, but give them entertainment, but make them also think.
Or absolutely.
Once that child walks away from that video game console, maybe perhaps Lucas has planted that little bit of a seed that will grow and encourage that child.
Kind of engage their minds as well as their
exactly. And I think that often gets overlooked with all the jokes and the negativity. He's very much big on, let's not just give them entertainment, but let's give them entertainment that's going to make them think. And so beyond just the video games that he produced through LucasArts, you know, as a storyteller, not just a filmmaker, he's always very focused on education and stuff. And even his most recent movie production, Red Tails, is a movie he's wanted to make since the 80s, which tells the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. And even though the characters in the movie itself are fictional, they're all based obviously on real people and real events. And so I think that just goes to show, you know, his love of history, his love of educating and being the new generation. You know, a story like the Tuskegee Airmen, he feels is important enough to keep alive and pass on to new viewers that may
Absolutely.
Not be familiar with the thing. So I think that's a very noble thing of him as a storyteller to do. And it's funny because even though talking about Red Tails, he wasn't so much a producer. He was the executive producer on it. A lot of people don't realize that he actually directed a lot of the reshoots himself personally.
Oh, really interesting.
So I guess that gives us another Lucas-directed movie.
In a sense, yes.
Yeah. Anything, Cole, that you want to touch on the father of Star Wars before
Absolutely.
We wrap things
up? I think, though, you know, we really did what we set out to do primarily, and that was to basically celebrate George Lucas, especially when there has been, you know, so much negativity. Is it Is it unfounded negativity? In some cases, probably not that much so. But
But it's definitely not at the level of, say, the People versus George Lucas. I mean,
I mean,
the man's not a criminal by any stretch of the imagination.
And, you know, it's easy to forget how much, you know, he's done right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, granted, some of the episodes 1 through 3 lacked in so many ways, and in some ways didn't feel very Star Wars. Certainly could have been, would have benefited greatly by having people say no, or, you know, letting somebody else take up the writing reins and listening to people. But at the same time, you know, there were some really great characters. There were some really great stuff that came out of that helped drive the legend, help drive the saga.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, what it comes down to is that, you know, how easy do we forget? This is but for George Lucas, there would not have been the Star Wars that we know and love. And, you know, it's not all bad. And there's a whole lot to celebrate, mm-hmm. and a whole lot to of just amazing stuff. And I, you know, perhaps in pursuing other visions, part of the original vision that got lost, but that doesn't really, it's no reason to invalidate the rest of the rest of the career and everything that George Lucas has brought to bear over the years.
I agree. And, you know, let's not forget that all of this that he has given us could have easily have never happened had things turned out differently on that dusty back road in Modesto, California. But thank the maker, things turned out okay.
That's right. Well, the Force was strong with him, and by no means weak-minded. He still had a tremendous influence on Alan Ladd Jr., which made a lot of things happen. The deck was stacked very much against.
Oh yeah, he did overcome quite a bit to give us the world that we can sit back and enjoy now.
So when you're choking down episodes 1 through 3, next time you decide you need a Star Wars marathon, and you're going to be loyal, and you're going to watch them all, and you're going to, you know, when you get that urge to start hating on Lucas, remember, if you're watching them in numerical order, the best is yet to come.
that's the truth.
And, you know, as we move forward into the new Disney owned era of Lucasfilm and all that will one day entail, this is just a great opportunity to really celebrate where it all got started. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we've helped remind people that you know, that it was an unlikely but amazing start that gave us all of these things, from, you know, the brilliant characters like Han Solo and Darth Vader, to Jar Jar Binks. So,
yeah, exactly. So, Lucas has handed over the reins to J.J. Abrams, and now that we found out just a few days ago, Rian Johnson for episode 8. Let's hope that, you know, J.J. Abrams and Johnson also have a good, clear focus on the Star Wars mythology, and hopefully take us into a new era. Take us back to good times.
I can't wait for the Dinobots. That's that other franchise that I don't.
Yeah, exactly. Thank goodness. You know what? Next time y'all guys want to complain about George Lucas, think to yourselves, thank goodness Michael Bay didn't get a hold
there
of Star
you go. There's your silver lining, folks. And with that, I want to thank everyone for listening. As always, apologies about our brief hiatus there. We're trying to get everything back on track, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with more Simple Tricks and Nonsense, and in 1 week with a live Rentcore Pit.
Good night, everybody.